Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. The request for the Dhamma talk keeps getting more and more beautiful every time. That's gonna have to have an orchestra in here pretty soon to make it any nicer. I guess to start the evening, I just wanted to just compliment everybody who's been living here in the community for the last, I don't know, just a little bit over, well, not quite 10 days, but since the big Ajahns have all been away. Had no doubts, but it's you know, from my perspective of sitting up front and having a little bit of sort of sense of responsibility, you know, looking after the community. I didn't have any doubts or any fears about it, but sometimes the reality is different. It's just been quite enjoyable that, you know, everybody's really made efforts to be harmonious like we always do. And so I just wanted to just express my appreciation to everybody for really making efforts for that to happen, make that manifest. It actually is part of the practice to, you know, for us to be having that attitude and having that, you know, making the efforts to live harmoniously. It's quite beautiful to see from my perspective of sitting in the hot seat. So last Saturday I gave just a little bit of a talk kind of on loving kindness practice. You know, part of the rationale behind that was to just sort of thinking that, you know, pretty soon the winter retreat is going to be coming on, and partly was to kind of talk about just the loving kindness, the sutta, Buddhist words on loving kindness as kind of, you know, looking at something to investigate, to look at, to explore, especially because the winter retreat is coming up, and, you know, since last week it was 6 weeks away, and now it's 5 weeks away. And so it's, you can see that time is moving very quickly, and we'll be in retreat. And as I kind of pointed out last week, that, you know, like what we're doing right now, what we've been doing this last week, you know, is setting the conditions for how our winter retreat will go. Just from my perspective of seeing the community, it seems like we're going in the right direction. You know, we are setting good, you know, intentions, good results. Hopefully we'll follow from that. As in any community, especially one, you know, is not that we're a huge community, big and small doesn't really apply, but in a community this size, there always are difficulties, there are issues or misunderstandings or, you know, misperceptions that do arise. And that's also, you know, sort of part of our practice is, you know, looking at those as well and using that as Dhamma practice. I was contemplating just sort of, again, picking up the Metta Sutta and sort of going through kind of the rest of the sutta, but, you know, the last couple of days in particular, you know, there have been some, you know, questions that have been asked or from various people. And one that was asked today was just sort of, You know, like, well, how does this practice work? How does the practice in terms of living in the monastery, you know, how does the training here, you know, I wouldn't say what the purpose of it is, but you know, like, how does it work? What's the structure? Where's the it wasn't asked in a negative way, but I've actually heard it from in several different angles, sort of the same sort of question. You know, it's a question that I ask myself quite a bit. You know, I'm sure all of us do too. And so, like, you know, in I think the entire time that I've lived at Abhayagiri, it's like, you know, it's probably one of the hardest places of practice is the kitchen. You know, just lots of people having, you know, food issues, you know, not necessarily saying that in a bad way, but just, you know, people have different opinions about food. People have different needs just around food, you know, like what is actually healthy for them and what isn't healthy for them. And you know, the longer that you, say, live in the monastery, and sort of the further we get away from having been responsible for the kitchen, it's easy to forget how much effort goes into preparing the meal for us. It's like when I was first here, back in the old days, you know, it was like two or three people would be assigned to work in the kitchen, you know, just to prepare a meal, you know, for the community. And the community was only like, you know, 10, 12 people, you know, but still you have two or three people, you know, preparing a meal for that, you know, that size community. You know, now since we have 40 people, 45 people here for the meal, it's still two or three people who are just preparing the meal. And, you know, I just find that a miracle that can happen. You know, the work period's not any longer than it was back then. And so, you know, for me, it's just really good to, you know, to reflect on, you know, just that generosity and the, you know, how much work actually does go into that. But, you know, in all the jobs we do, in the administrative aspect of it, you know, the things that have to happen for the website or the things that have to happen for there to be water pressure, you know, for us to be able to take showers and to be able to have, you know, adequate drinking water and things like that, and just all the maintenance that happens in all the buildings. And, you know, there's certain individuals here who are extremely gifted with you know, practical knowledge and things like that, and they often get, you know, more requests made from them. A lot of their free time that some people, you know, have for, you know, studying and meditating and things like that, those monks or community members might be, you know, doing projects that, you know, we can look at it from the outside and think, oh, well, they just like being busy, and they actually might. It might actually be beneficial to their practice to give them something to focus on and to create good karma. And for those people, you know, might be good, or they might also be feeling resentment and anger and, you know, like, well, you know, why, even though I have this skill, why am I the person that always has to go out and do this? Why am I the one that has to make sure the kitchen's spotlessly clean? You know, if I don't do this, cockroaches are going to take over. You know, we can, you know, have those mind states, you know, sort of pop in a negative way, and can just, you know, really ruin all the sort of good karma, the good actions and good intentions that we had. You know, if we are sort of, maybe a strong word, but sort of negligent in allowing those thoughts to arise and then feeding them, allowing them to be there. Whereas, you know, you could also be doing, and I know there are people here who do, you know, sort of say, take on those duties and those responsibilities and actually take a lot of joy in it, and realizing that, yeah, they're actually helping other people, or maybe even having the thought that, you know, by my doing this, then it does allow somebody to have that opportunity to study or to have time to be out doing walking meditation on like a beautiful day like we had today. And so you can take a lot of joy in that same mind state. While I was meditating, I was just I really didn't know what I was gonna, even what kind of theme I was gonna pursue. I was just thinking, it's like going over the second half of the Metta Sutta, but it wasn't until about 5-10 minutes left in my sit that whatever I'm going to be talking about, because I don't even know 100% for sure, but kind of came into my head about 10 minutes before the sit-in ended. And I got this really strong image of a story that I was told when I was living in an ashram in Massachusetts. And so it was a story that was told to me, so it was pretty vague. And I can see how my mind is actually sort of filling in all the sort of details of the story, which may or may not be 100% true. But the gist of the story was that there was a young man. I kind of laughed when I started thinking about the story, because when I heard the story, that young man was 20 years old in my mind, and I just told the story, but now that young man's about 45. So there was a young man at this ashram, and he was dying of cancer, and the guru had invited him to come up and sit with him in front of the whole group. And this ashram was a very large ashram, so probably about 300 people were kind of, 300 to 800 people were sitting there for one of the satsangs, sort of devotional services. And he just wanted this young man to sort of share with the community, just sort of something of what, maybe some words of inspiration, or just, he was, I guess he was, I remember the story, he was close to dying. He was very well advanced in his cancer, but was still living in the community. And the story I was told, actually several people I think told me this, so it must have made a really big impression at the time, but the young man just sort of just came up and was just sitting next to the guru, and he was just radiating just love, just sort of like pure joy on his face, even though he was, probably, I don't know, I'm guessing, very close to death, and he was just radiating this real joy. And the only thing he said, and he repeated it several times, was something like, get what you came here for. And he was just radiant, and he just kept saying that, get what you came here for. And so as I was thinking about that during the end of the sit, it's like, we all came here for some reason. Every one of us, we have some expectation, some hope. We had some idea of what coming to a monastery would do. Might just be that you came to see your son. Might be that you wanted to learn meditation. Might be that you came to be generous in some way. Might be that you came to seeking an end of suffering, to have an idea of what enlightenment is, and you had some sort of confidence that this would be a good place to investigate that, to see if it's a possibility. So it's, not, even though we are all here sort of, working together and creating an environment, it's like not all of our, intentions or expectations, even, what we hope to get are the same. But I think all of it's probably very wholesome. There's some very wholesome intentions, and it's good to be really clear. It's like, why, what is it that brought you here? And and checking in on that, periodically, to sort of, there was something about the way I was living my life that was not satisfactory, that maybe was, maybe you were doing everything that that society had been telling you to do, that you felt, you know, they felt, you know, was leading in the right direction, and, you know, but maybe you saw that that was hollow, or, you know, it wasn't really fulfilling. And so the, you know, the mind turned, and somehow we had the good fortune to, you know, to come across the Buddhist teachings, and say for, you know, for most of us that you know, there was a hope, you know, there was some sort of something about those teachings that did move us, did bring us here. And so it's, you know, good to you remember that, and to, you know, so what was it that brought me here, and then, you know, what have I been doing, you know, for the last however long you've been here? You know, have you been moving in that direction? Have you been taking steps to actually to try to realize that, to bring that to fruition? Or have we gotten into a rut, or, you know, because there's lots of responsibilities, there's lots of duties, there's lots of, especially if you're doing hard physical labor, you know, it can be, or if your health isn't so good, you know, it can maybe, when you came here, you had lots of energy, and you had lots of, you know, the vitality of youth, and you can get sidetracked, and then, you know, then when you get a little bit older or get sick, and you don't have that energy, and so you might, you know, there's that sutta on right effort, or, you know, it's like, oh, I ate too much, so I'll go get some sleep, and then, you know, once I'm not feeling drowsy from the sleep, then I'll practice, and then, or I'm feeling sick, so, you know, I'll just get some rest, and then when I'm better, then I'll practice. And so there's always a reason to sort of put off the practice. So just, you know, just keep coming back to one of the ways of right effort, bringing up that resolve, is just to, you know, just to bring to mind, what is it that brought us here? And that's usually a pretty strong desire, a wholesome desire, and pretty strong intention. So just really keep connecting with it. And with the, you know, like, how does this practice work? You know, the monastic form, because it's at least the monastic form, the way it's practiced at Abhayagiri, because it's a, if you've practiced in Thailand and lived in other monasteries, you know, even within the Ajahn Chah tradition, even within just the Western monks of Ajahn Chah, the various monasteries, you know, each monastery has a different flavor to it, a different way of, you know, all the different, the way that the practices are taught. And it usually does come down to the senior monk, you know, it's what direction that particular teacher feels comfortable with, because he or she will have a lot of responsibilities, and, you know, they're gonna, you know, hopefully teach from ways that they know that, you know, have worked for them, or examples that they've seen, and coming from their strengths, and so each monastery is different. So I can really, myself, I can only kind of talk about from Abhayagiri mainly, and just the few monasteries that I have visited. But I remember when I was, I guess I still would have been a samanera, a novice, and I was in this room in here sewing my, you know, three robes for the ordination, and when we were sewing that, they were actually building the Pasako, and I, the man I ordained with, were in here sewing together, and they were building both of the wings on this building. You know, we were kind of in here, you know, sewing, and I remember some guests came in one time, and they go, "Isn't that disturbing to you? You know, all that noise, because, you know, saws going and hammers going, and you were in here sewing." And I remember just stopping and listening, going, "No, that's music to my ears, you know, listening to all that." Because as soon as, you know, adding space to the monasteries, we don't have to crawl over each other. But I remember just finishing my robe, and it takes somewhere, it depends on how skilled of a sewer you are, but somewhere between 40 and 80 hours of sewing to sort of do a do a complete set of the robes that you need to have before you can ordain. And in our tradition, we sew them all ourselves. And sometimes it's the first time people have actually been on a sewing machine. And when you're doing the sanghati, it's a really the robe that's over our shoulders, the one that we're not, it's kind of just folded over our left shoulders. And it's a really complicated way of sewing it, because all the seams are in the inside of the robe. It's a two-layer piece of cloth, but all the seams are in the inside, so it's kind of like these whole bunch of little pillowcases that you're always sewing from the inside and then pulling it out. And it just takes a real long time. And I remembered there was some sort of aspect of it that you sew the first seam that you're sewing, you sew it, and you stop about a half inch before you get to the corner. And then you flip it over, but somehow the thread goes all the way into the corner. And the first time I saw that, my mind was like, how in the world is that? I was like, wait, you don't need to worry about it. It worked. Don't try to figure out. You got 79 more hours worth of sewing to do. Just trust that it works. And every single time I did that and turned it over, it's like the mind would ask the question. Every single time, it's like, how did it do that? And every single time, I would just, don't proliferate, just, it works, do it. And then I finished the robe, and I was carrying the sewing machine out to the storage shed where we kept it. And I passed Debbie, and she was walking by, and I was all excited that I finished the robe. And I told her that story. I said, every single time that I came into the corner, and I said, I never answered, never tried to answer the question. I said, that was the real miracle, so that I actually had the discipline not to try to intellectually figure it out. And Debbie just looked at me and goes, you'll figure it out, don't worry. It was this kind of funny moment. She said, you'll figure it out. And then I just walked over to the shed, which is kind of right where the boot room is now, and I just set the sewing machine down on the table where we stored it on. And as soon as I set the sewing machine down, the answer popped into my head. He just said, oh, that's how it happens. And I thought that was like this really kind of profound thing. It's like, I didn't spend any time at all trying to, figure out the answer. But the question was there. The question just kept coming up, kept reinforcing itself. And, I just let the question be there and didn't try to answer it. And so that to me was like the real sort of like, that was really kind of this major kind of insight. And then right after that, I saw Ajahn Pasano, and I told him that, to explain the whole story. And he said, yes, that's exactly how the holy life works. He said, there is a training, and, just put yourself into it. Throw yourself into it with your whole heart. Just, you don't need to try to figure out all the ins and outs and, why this matches up with that and things like that. But it's basically just... do the practices that's sort of laid out. That doesn't mean that you don't question. It's like if I had, turned the robe inside, so the proper side was showing, and didn't line up, if it was messed up or something like that, it wouldn't be, well, don't worry about it. Just keep sewing. It's like, no, do it correctly, do it right, do it by the instructions. Try to figure out. There are questions to ask and using wisdom. But the main part is just doing the practice, and if you're doing it correctly, and you're doing it with guidance of a community and teacher, and you're doing it correctly, then the results will come. The robe will get finished, and you may even have understanding at the end of it of how it worked. So I was really profound. I was really struck by Ajahn Pasano Sutra just summing that up. Yeah, that's exactly how the holy life works. And then, kind of on a similar note, just sort of like, how things work, or this was, I think, my first week in the monastery. We were starting just to build the loop trail. It started at the Dhamma Hall clearing and only went in about 40 feet into the forest. We were the whole community. It's like every single day, like everybody in the community except for who was cooking would go out and work on it, including Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro. And one day Ajahn Pasano and I were working closer to the Dhamma Hall clearing, and Ajahn Amaro and somebody else were working further up the trail. And they had a bunch of tools, I think it was in a wheelbarrow, that they were going to have to bring out afterwards. And they were digging, and they were all the gravel and all the rocks and stuff that they were digging were coming onto the trail they were working on. And Ajahn Pasano and I looked at each other. We knew what they were doing, like the mess they were creating, or the rocks were in their way. So like the work period is coming close to the end, and that they weren't gonna be able to get out because they were blocking themselves in on this trail. And I remember just watching this, kind of being amused by it. And Ajahn Pasano and I had this kind of smile and had a chuckle about it. And then sure enough, as soon as the work period is over, we kind of watched them. They were trying to figure out how to undo their mistake and to clear off the trail. And then they came up. And then later in the day, I was talking to Ajahn Pasano, and I just sort of said, why didn't you say anything to Ajahn Amaro? He would have had to yell down to him. It wasn't like we were working right with him. But, I was like, it would have been quite easy for him just to yell down and sort of point out his error. And he said, people have to figure it out on their own. I was like, I can tell people what to do all day long, but nobody would learn. It's like part of the training here is that, we do have to, it's okay to fail. It's okay to make errors and to not do everything absolutely perfectly, but it's, developing that wisdom aspect of mind that investigates. So like if you do make a mistake, you do have an error, that's okay. We have a lot of permission here to fail. And maybe it's not expressed enough, but I think that's why I'm allowed to give Dhamma talks. So I'm allowed to fail and give a Dhamma talk now. It's okay. It's a small group. But then hopefully with all the things that we're doing here, we can learn from that. But Ajahn Pasano did say, it's like he would have intervened. He would have intervened in that situation. And he wasn't joking. And he said, if they were going to hurt themselves, if they physically would have hurt themselves, or sort of damage the property in some way, or if it would have cost the monastery any money, if it would have been kind of an error that would have been sort of disastrous. There are probably other reasons he may have intervened too, but basically it's like, yeah, it wasn't going to hurt them, it wasn't going to cost any money, and they probably learned from that, just pay a little bit more attention to what they were doing, think about things in the a little bit bigger context than is what they were doing. And kind of in another sort of vein with this, there was a time when there was a monk who was kind of struggling and was creating a lot of work and just doing lots of things in the afternoon and sort of dragging people into the work projects, and it was kind of it was a pretty tense summer, partly because of this, and I remember several people, not just myself, but I remember it got to a point where I went to Ajahn Pasano once, and I sort of said, pointing out to him, several things that had happened, and I remember he sort of, agreed with me, like, yeah, those, that's not really appropriate, or, the Ajahns were, both Ajahn Amaro and him were sort of giving everybody in the community sort of, really strong in permission, like during the sharing, the morning reflection, sort of, saying stuff like, get back to your cabins, go back to your cabins in the afternoon, that's why they're there, we want you to meditate. But then this monk was, sort of going around and, specifically asking people, if it, in a community like this, it's kind of difficult if you're junior and someone senior to you is sort of asking you to do things, it can be difficult to say no. And so a lot of people, did, and they were feeling resentful and getting burned out. And myself and other people, so there wasn't just myself, but a lot of other people have gone to Ajahn Pasno with their complaints and stuff. And I don't know, I probably wasn't 100% serious with this, but I asked Ajahn Pasno, I said, why don't you ask that monk to leave? You know, disrobe or anything like that, but he's creating a lot of difficulty. Why don't you ask that person to leave? And Ajahn Pasno's response was, he said, you know, as long as somebody wants to be here, and somebody wants to be training, and they're keeping precepts, then, you know, that person's welcome. You know, that person, you know, as long as they're willing to train, willing to you know, put forth the effort, in you know, I won't say just to that degree, because that's pretty major. And, you know, wanting to follow precepts and wanting to train. There might be other instances. You know, there might be. I'm not saying that is Lumpur's final say on, you know, if someone's allowed to stay here. But you know, he was making a really nice statement there. That, you know, that is the training, you know, and anyone who's willing to do that, then, you know, they're welcome to be here. You know, just recently we were on alms round. This has been the last year. We were on alms round in Ukiah, and somebody who was looked like they were just by the sound of him, he was just really having a very difficult time of his life, or just had a very difficult life, and sounds like the social services had taken away his children or his child or something, and it was very, very bitter, and he was really kind of angry, and he kind of just came up to us and was kind of asking for, you know, help. I don't know if he was just wanting to be, you know, someone to listen to him, or if he was hoping for advice, or wanted us to intervene. You know, it was kind of hard to tell, but there was some sort of anger and sort of panic in his voice, and I was just like, you know, you want to help people, because it's like, you know, wow, how are we going to do anything to help this person? I was grateful that I was second or third monk there. I wasn't having to deal with it, because I didn't know how I would do it, what I would say to this person. And Ajahn Pasno just looked at him. He said something to the effect of, like, you know, do you keep precepts? You know, do you have, you know, good sila? And you know, he said it in a way that person would understand. And she looked at him and goes, how can I? You know, they've stolen my children. And Ajahn Pasno just turned around and walked away. And I was just like, you know, that was brilliant. He was like, he was just right at that sort of basic level. It's like, you know, is this person willing to look at themselves? Are they willing to sort of admit, you know, if they've done anything wrong in the situation? Are they willing to do something to improve themselves? And, you know, this man was just immediately, you know, blame and, you know, not taking responsibility. And so, and I thought that was a brilliant teaching to the man too, because it's like, you know, all he said was, you know, just brought up the fact of morality. You know, are you living a moral life? And then as soon as he, you know, basically said no, or said he wasn't willing to, then it's like, you know, by his turning away, it's like, if he had any ability to reflect, he would think, oh, you know, if I had said yes, then maybe he would have helped me. And that's what you can hope, that person would get that. So in terms of, you know, sort of, you know, like, when we do, you know, take on responsibilities here and, you know, want to, or do, especially if we, you know, taking on responsibilities and duties, and we start to feel resentful or feel like it's too much, or especially if it's not even like feeling resentful, just maybe even feeling like other people aren't pulling their weight, you know, like someone's said they would help you and then they end up not doing that, or, you know, just feeling like, you know, there's requests for help to do something, and there's certain individuals that never raise their hands, you know, and you know, you may not know that they're doing other things, they have other responsibilities, or there, you know, there might actually be reasons why, but we don't know that, but we just see that they never raise their hands, so we might get judgmental, and so it's like, you know, so how do we deal with that? You know, how do we handle situations where there's major aversion, or we're feeling burnout, or just feeling like, that's it, I'm out of here. No one's helping me, I'm getting out of here. How do we deal with those situations? How do we deal with those mind states? Where's the training? Why isn't Ajahn Pasano in there fixing this? That person's not progressing in their practice. They're not helping. They haven't learned anything about generosity. Where's the practice? These thoughts might be coming up. And so, the two things that come to my mind is they're completely contradictory. Because one is, it's ultimately it is just about ourselves. So it's a learning to give space to other people, to just to learn from our own reaction, just sort of sitting back and watching that. So it's like, one level it is doing nothing, but then there's another level where it's there are times when it is appropriate to speak up of if someone legitimately isn't say like living up to they've made a promise and they've not done it. It's like, not necessarily, this is where I guess where I was last week kind of talking about loving kindness, was that it's like we can bring up those sort of things with people, without blaming, without shaming, and without trying to make the other person feel bad. Because it oftentimes, especially in this kind of community, it often is a misunderstanding or miscommunication, because everybody here did arrive here with really good intentions and has good intentions. There's all of our negative tendencies or defilements are still there, and occasionally it's like I see in myself a lot of times that humor sometimes, like I'll be talking to somebody and say something humorously, and they're actually sometimes, not always, but sometimes there's a sort of stab in there, sort of like trying to, like maybe felt like, like somebody had said they would do something and they didn't, and then I sort of make a joke about something completely different, but you can tell there's a little barb in there. So it's like sometimes, we do have those negative aspects of us do come out in very subtle ways, sometimes in very gross ways. But so a lot of the practice is, is this balance between how do you just be with that dukkha that we're feeling for whatever the cause or whatever the reason, and just learning to be with unpleasant sensation, maybe learning to be okay with being misunderstood. And just learning to, even if you're right, even if that person was wrong, and you're just sort of looking at this righteous indignation, and so part of the practice is that just saying that righteous indignation. It's like maybe there's something about that state that we actually like. It's Lumpurse Mato, I was listening to a talk of his last year, and I remember him saying, righteous indignation. He goes, that's really one fun horse to ride. It's like you really feel alive when you're indignant. It's like all rationalities, sort of thrown out the window, and you're right, and you're on fire, and it's just like, it doesn't matter that you're burning the town down behind you, but you're right, and it's going to come back and burn you eventually, but it might feel good in that moment. If we kind of get in that feeling of never feeling alive, unless we've really got some sort of issue to be pushing and stuff like that, we can get into a habit or a trap of kind of living our life that way. And it doesn't have to be sort of this like flaming sort of righteous indignation. It might just be something just smoldering below the surface that I'm right about everything, but that sort of energy is what maybe is fueling us, is keeping us, giving us the energy to live in a celibate community, and maybe that's how we're raising our energy, trying to dissipate it or something like that. It's just good to investigate. So you know, part of it is learning just to sit back and watch and not react, not to move on to those feelings, and just see, try to understand how they arise. What does it feel like? What's it do to us when it's there? You know, once you really kind of get to understand those feelings and emotions, and then, you know, then it's really picking it apart with wisdom. It's really investigating it and, you know, seeing that, there's causes and conditions. You know, oftentimes when I do the sort of practice and looking at it, it's amazing to me, like, how many times it's really just a misperception. You know, sort of like when I do kind of, you know, look at it and take it apart, it's like, you know, there's some sort of supposition, some sort of idea or view that I have about a particular situation that, well, you know, maybe nobody else in the community actually has that same view or that same value, or, you know, it's something that I've taken on, and I just feel like, you know, it's something that, you know, I grew up with this as a value, and so I just, you know, it's the most natural thing in the world, so everybody should have the same value. Then you start sort of questioning that and talking to other people, and, you know, it's like, no, we don't actually do that way in California. You know, and you start realizing, oh, you know, you're just looking at things this way and sort of questioning our assumptions and values, and oftentimes we'll find out that, you know, we'll always find out we are the ones that are creating our own problems. So that's one aspect, is sitting back and watching and investigating. But there is a factor of you know, learning to communicate, you know, learning to talk to people, to give feedback. You know, sometimes it's giving feedback in a positive way. But I think more times it's more skillful to think of it as, you know, like if someone's said that they would do something and they didn't, and then you feel like you're overburdened or resentful for that. It's like, you know, just learning to, you know, in a way that's not confrontational, but to find out from the other person their perspective of what happened. Because, again, in many situations like this, it often is a misperception, or some other factors has come into it, like a senior monk has, you know, come up to that person, you know, like they said they would be, you know, willing to drive you into town, you know, or something like that, and then that day comes and, you know, they're not there. But, you know, maybe Ajahn Yatiko or the work monk, you know, there was an emergency that had to happen and they sent them off. You know, we didn't know that. Or sometimes, you know, like, you look around at morning puja and there might be two or three monks not here, and, you know, just initially, like, you know, someone has a reputation of missing morning puja every once in a while, and you just kind of see that person's there, not there, and you might have this, you know, sort of negative judgment come up and go, oh, he's doing it again. But it turns out he's sick, you know, he's completely laid out in his bed, and he's sick, and we're having all these judgment of the person. Or now that it's winter time, you know, it's like when there's no hot water up at the mub, it's like one of the monks in the morning has to go up and fire up the boiler, and that takes all morning to do. So it's like sometimes you look over and judgmental that the monk's not here. He might actually be working at 4 in the morning and has permission not to be there, but no one's ever told us that. So there's... you know, so it's kind of good to learn to not like every single situation. I mean, definitely, I think most situations not. It's like Ajahn Chah said, you know, like 95% of the practice should be sort of looking at ourselves, and only 5% sort of looking externally. But in those 5%, it is, you know, it's good to learn. You know, it is good to exercise that 5%. It's good to learn how to talk to somebody, to learn how to ask questions, to, because, you know, in asking that, sometimes, you know, like if someone is having a problem or is having difficulties, or like maybe making it to morning puja and stuff like that, you know, sometimes just if everybody in the community just ignores it and doesn't sort of say anything, you know, because it's like maybe it is annoying everybody that someone's missing, you know, but it might be helpful for that person if, you know, somebody did come up to them and say, you know, oh, we've noticed you haven't been to puja, you know, the last 3 days, you know, is everything okay? Instead of coming up to him and saying, you're a horrible monk, you know, you never come to morning puja, you're a lousy person. And you know, there have been times when people have probably done that to people. You know, so learning to, you know, to approach in a skillful way. And also, it's for myself, I know it's if you know, somebody is acting unskillful, somebody is being really bossy or being selfish and things like that, and there might, you know, and from our perspective, there might be a reason to approach the person and talk to him about that. You know, there's a real, for me, there's a real hesitancy. Like I would much rather just sort of push it under the carpet and not have to deal with it, because it's you know, it's dukkha. It's not pleasant to have to, you know, talk to somebody about something they're doing wrong, especially if you suspect that they're not going to be appreciative of the good advice you have for them. You know, they're going to be negative, and so, or take it wrongly, or it's somebody that you actually do value their friendship, or maybe somebody that's probably more common if it's someone that you don't really have a great relationship with, but you feel like for some reason it's your duty, your responsibility to say something to them. You know, like in the world, if it was like an employer, you know, sometimes it's kind of difficult to have to say something to your employees, or you know, if you're a parent, sometimes it's difficult to say no to your children and things like that. So, but it's in the long run, it's better to occasionally, if the situation calls for it, to learn how to approach somebody and talk to them. The nice thing about living in a community like this, with the, you know, like someone with Lumpur around, you know, it's good to, if you can find the time to talk to him or any of the other senior monks, you know, just to, you know, pass it by people first. That's always a really valuable thing to do, because you know, usually the group mind is much better than the individual mind. So like if you think that, you know, something's out of whack, something's not appropriate happening, and or you want to say something to somebody, like this happened to Ajahn Amaru a few years back, about 10 years back now, where a monk had written to Ajahn Amaro and had given him, I think it was a 30-page critique of one of his books, and it was all negative, and he was wanting to sort of, his initial reaction was kind of to go blast that monk, but I knew a little bit of information about that particular person, and told Ajahn Amaro, you know, Ajahn Amaro asked me if I knew this person, and I told him a little bit of his history, and he's like, oh, I'm so glad you said that, because I'm not going to respond the way that I thought I was going to. And so sometimes if you feel like you really really strongly feel like something needs to be said, it's good to check it out with one or two or three people. You know, usually someone who you trust. It doesn't have to be a senior monk. It can just be someone that you just know. That person's usually really skillful around speech, or that person's really, you know, I've seen them deal with situations skillfully before, or, you know, that person knows that person or something like that, you know, to sort of just, you know, just learning how to either to, you know, to talk to someone directly, or just learning how to deal with the situation. And sometimes that is to talk to other people instead of the person. So it's just sort of learning in interpersonal relationship skills. That actually is an aspect of monastic form and living in a monastery. So I just want to kind of stress that, I don't know how this sounded to you, but it's not an admonishment in any way, because in many ways the last 10 days have been, from my perspective, been very harmonious. And I have seen people, helping out and working out, anything that I've brought up has not been any issue that I have with anybody else. But these are sort of questions and things that over the last decade plus that I've been living here, these are questions that have arisen in my mind, and things being in the robes, being here even as a layperson and training, because it's like even some of the stories I've told, or even when I was a layperson, so these things do come up. Ajahn Amaro used to always end his talks by saying that if I've said anything in this talk that's been useful and helpful for your practice, then great, take that and use that. If it hasn't been, then just set that aside. There's probably more I could say, but I think I will end it at that.
Sadhu, sadhu.